Semi Stefano Liberati, in the future seminar, telling us about the next Gen Gravity Challenge.
Okay, thanks a lot for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here today. Well, today's talk, it will be a kind of salad putting together many apparently disconnected parts of my research, which I think nonetheless may have a kind of unified feature, and this is what I will try to convey. Let's start talking about emergent gravity first, if I manage to. So, what is emergent gravity? You know, I would say that nowadays it's a kind of set of ideas. You cannot say that there is a true emergent gravity framework. In a certain sense, the basic idea is that underlying gravity, there are degrees of freedom which are not gravitational. There is something, some other kind of theory, possibly quantum theory, that is not a gravity theory. Somehow this theory underwent some sort of phase transition and generate space and time as we know them, and their dynamics. And of course, there are tantalizing evidence that somehow there is something weird with gravity. And of course, historically, the first one was the discovery of black hole thermodynamics. The fact that black holes behave like thermodynamical objects, and the fact that somehow theorem of GR can be interpreted as thermodynamical laws, while quantum field theory in curved spacetime provide you with a consistent result that there is Hawking radiation, and so you can attribute the temperature to this object, there was for sure a first evidence. And then I have here a kind of list of what to me seems to be a set of evidence that in recent time also has appeared and that seems to push toward an emergent gravity picture. Of course, once you embrace an emergent gravity picture, many things in gravity start to appear different. For example, in a certain sense, you would consider that all the physics we live in is a kind of low-energy physics with respect to the planescape, because you think that the planescape is where this transition happens. And things like singularities in space-time, you would naturally expect them to see them as phase transition, because what are normally phase transition, thermodynamical potential diverge, but now in space-time, in black hole thermodynamics, some of these thermodynamic potential are related to curvature. So you would say that a singularity has to be replaced by some sort of phase transition in the theory. What we're talking about is not clear. And then there is also the cosmological constant, and I will discuss this in this talk. The cosmological constant, as probably all of you know, is a problem nowadays, because we have realized that there seems to be, there is evidence through the acceleration of the cosmological expansion that there is a violation of the strong energy condition. That means that there is some kind of exotic matter, but this matter seems indeed to be a cosmological constant. But a cosmological constant is problematic because our way of estimating the cosmological constant as the energy associated with the vacuum provides you with a completely wrong result, not what is sometimes called the most wrong calculation that you can do, because it's many order of magnitude, too many order of magnitude off the mark to be even close to have some relation to the real result. And what is the cosmological constant in emergent gravity? Is this the ground state energy? And if the system is emergent, somehow we will see that is in order to compute the cosmological constant, you have absolutely to rely on the knowledge of the microscopic system. There is no way you're going to predict the cosmological constant from the emergent system. So, as a first, the first slide, I decided after many thoughts to try to give what for me is a very strong evidence for emergent gravity, which is related to somewhat an old result that recently got rediscovered in the literature and had also some development. This result is the derivation of Einstein equation that was proposed by Ted Jacobson in 1995. And I want to give you why people that work in this field consider this result something that, or admit my take on why this result is strongly linked toward emergent gravity. So, to give you, to discuss properly this derivation, I would need to give many technical details that there is no time to give, and I don't know if it would be at all useful in this moment. So let me try to give you the gist of the derivation. The gist of the derivation is the following. You use the equivalence principle, and in particular, I mean at least the Einstein equivalence principle, that means that you have universality of free fall, local Lorentz invariance, and position invariance on non-gravitational experiments. So start with that. If there is local Lorentz invariance, you can always take a sufficiently small patch of space-time where the space-time looks flat. Okay? In a flat space-time, you know that, thanks to the Poincaré group, there is a Killing vector, a local Killing vector in this case, which is associated to boost. Okay? So what you can build is that around any point of space-time in a sufficiently small patch, you can build a Rindler wedge. That means a particular mapping of Minkowski space as it's seen by uniformly accelerated observer which are moving through this epiphora. There are immediately what you have is that you are endowed with a Terman system because a uniformly accelerated observer will detect Uhru radiation, right? Now, Jacobson what proposed was to assume that a Clausius law holds for this system. So, if I have influxes of matter through this horizon, this non-congruence describing this horizon will be change and focus on the focus and will change the cross-sectional area of this horizon. Okay? So what you're doing is you are computing the flux and the flux takes this form. So technically, basically what is happening is you compute the energy current contracting the stress energy tensor for matter with the Killing vector associated to which generates this horizon. And then you have a volume element, this is to the two-dimensional cross-section. Lambda is the affine parameter along the horizon. And you have a vector A, which is the vector affinely parametrized tangent to the horizon. This is, will be the, your heat fluxes. Why you don't put P de V? Why you don't put a first law there? Because basically the horizon thermalizes everything, so there is no meaning in which you can distinguish anything from simple heat, right? T is going to be the Uhru temperature. DS, what is going to be DS? Well, DS can be, here there is the second fundamental assumption. You assume that the entropy of this system is the only entropy you can define on a system where basically there is a gravity, where a flat space. So what is the only entropy you can define? It's the entanglement entropy. The entropy associated with the fact that you have a quantum state and there is entanglement through this causal horizon. And the entanglement entropy is known to be proportional to the area. The area can be expressed as, so the DS is this cutoff, because it generates the entanglement entropy is divergent. We assume this cutoff to be constant, that implies that given that the cutoff is a gravitational region, now we are assuming the full strong energy, strong equivalence principle. So also the disposition independent of gravitational experiment. And the expression for the variation of the area is basically an expression calculated around the point P. And doing an expansion, you have theta, the expansion of the congruence, plus the theta de lambda times lambda. The theta de lambda is nothing else than the Rechel equation. Okay? So now that you have the two expressions, you equate them. And you furthermore use the fact that you want the stress energy tensor to be covariantly conserved. These are the only ingredients that you put in. Now, if you see that this theta has no lambda in front of it, while this is everything proportional to lambda, so theta has to be zero. The expansion has to be zero, so this term is zero. Then you have a term in the shear square. Let me throw it away for the moment. Let's consider that the shear square is zero, the shear of the congruence is zero. Then you are left with this term. You equate this term, you use covariant conservation and you get the Einstein equation plus an undetermined cosmological constant. Of course, you don't get G Newton. G Newton is completely undetermined. You a posteriori recognize that it should be related this way to alpha. Okay? So G Newton is not determined by the thermodynamical relation. It's just somehow related to the gravitational cutoff. And lambda is not determined. The constant in the gravitational theory are undetermined through this, this thermodynamical argument. This is a very important point. Good. Why? I mean, this could be a good intel for emergence, but I think that there is more. And what people often forget is that there was that shear, the shear term that I threw away. If I don't throw it away, I don't get the Einstein equation. Now, it was recognized later on, initially by Jacobson, and very close studies also by us, that if you try to generalize this construction, for example, to f of r theories of gravity, it looks like you have no reason to put the shear equal to zero. And the shear is totally arbitrary because, in a certain sense, in this construction, the shear of the congruence is not something determined by space-time. You don't want to rely on any property of the solution of the metric on which you are doing this construction. This, you want to do space-time thermodynamics, not the thermodynamics of a particular solution of the earth. So if you don't throw the shear away, you are obliged to generalize your principle, your Clausius equation, to what is called the near equilibrium Clausius equation, and to separate a reversible part and an irreversible part. The reversible part is what we saw before. The irreversible part would look like this, and would look like a term which is bulk viscosity in hydrodynamics, and this would be a shear viscosity term. Now, if you do the procedure as I told you before for GR, you get basically that the bulk viscosity has to be zero and the shear viscosity is instead this term. And this term is exactly the Hartle-Hawking tidal heating, is the dissipation of your thermodynamical system with an horizon, which generally it was associated for black hole to the emission of gravitational waves. And this answers a very interesting question, because you could have asked me before, where are the gravitational waves in Jacobson derivation? Why cannot put the flux of gravitational wave? They can change the area. And you cannot, because there is no covariantly conserved stress energy tensor. But this shear viscosity term is exactly the Hartle-Hawking tidal heating, is in the irreversible part. And here comes a good point. You know? So what are gravitational waves? They are the analog of, in this thermodynamical interpretation, of heat flux. So Q here is the energy exchanged by the system with the environment. Can be part of a reversible process. This part is the exchange of energy with the internal degrees of freedom. If you can heat it, it has internal degrees of freedom. So I would say that the presence of a term like this, this shear viscosity term, is a strong indication that there are internal degrees of freedom to gravity. So, also, it gives you a very nice picture of why we have all these problems to describe fluxes of gravitational wave. They are not on the space-time. They are in the space-time. It's different. It's not a phonon. It's something like this. It's a neat flux inside. You can still transport energy with this, of course, but you will excite internal degrees of freedom to the space-time.
Stefano, if you are chromatizing everything up, can you distinguish internal from...
No, it's here. They distinguish, the distinction is the way they enter. This part is irreversible, it's non-local. The difference is exactly in the non-locality. You see, the problem is that here you cannot take away from this integral this part. You cannot produce this term in each point of space-time. In the previous slide, I was recovering the Einstein equation, but you need to equate the integrants and say that regulation holds in any point of space-time. Here, instead, it is just a dissipative property of your thermodynamical system, the Rindler wedge, the local Rindler wedge. There is no dissipation. The space-time is reversible. There is no dissipation. Of course, in this derivation, they also find that there was a bulk viscosity for f of r theories of gravity, and this is problematic because it was recognized that bulk viscosity can be always recast going to, in f of r, you can always relate it to a scalar tensor theory. And a scalar tensor theory takes this form. And this form allows you to just take this and put it in the reversible part of the equation, take away the integral, peel off the case, and then you would have that there would be bulk viscosity at each point of space-time. And this doesn't make sense, because you know that the dynamics of gravity is reversible. So the only way out is that you recognize what is the way out of this problem. When you have a seek from the scalar tensor theory point of view, when you do a scalar tensor theory of gravity, your cutoff for the entropy, the one alpha, has to be promoted to a field, because you are using just the Einstein equivalence principle. You are not assuming that the gravity is the same in each point. But once alpha becomes a field, if you don't want to have background dependence, you need to give a flux to alpha. So you will have a corresponding flux term in the heat flux, in the cube, not the heat flux, in the energy fluxes. So what is happening is that if to restore background independence, each scalar field that you put will have its own stress-energy tensor. You can write down a covariant stress-energy tensor. You have to account for it, put it in the equation, and at that point it will cancel this, will always cancel this bulk viscosity term. And so the dynamics of gravity is always, in these two cases that we have been able to do, GR and the scalar tensor theory, that of basically incompressible fluid, because you can see the Rashadoui equation basically describing for you a fluid of the you can describe the null congruence as a fluid, which is in perfect agreement with what is recently found in gravity fluid duality approaches, where you find that the projected Einstein equation on null slices is basically an incompressible null source.
How is a scalar like an incompressible fluid?
Once we don't have a bulk viscosity, basically bulk viscosity is zero. So here you don't see a fluid equation, basically, but you can interpret the fact that you have zero bulk viscosity is in agreement with the fact that in other approaches, the one related initially to the SCFT, and now there are these approaches that are strong, where they're trying to do this in asymptotically flat space-time, they find that the equation describing the horizon is basically an incompressible null Stokes. So it becomes, it seems to be in agreement with this kind of approach.
So then the incompressible fluid lies on the boundary of space time. So here you're talking about incompressible fluid.
Line is the horizon.
On the horizon?
Yeah, no, not on the horizon, it's the horizon. The horizon can be described as an incompressible fluid. So this is for me is a very good indication that there is something. I mean, the viscosity term is, if you like, more important than the thermodynamical derivation. And I think, for example, Ted Jacobson agree on this point. This point about the shear viscosity is really very important, I think. So it's just an highlight that I wanted to do and an argument why I think it's interesting to pursue this idea. Now, going on, I want now to focus because, in a certain sense, okay, that's all nice, but what we can do with this emergent gravity idea? So, of course, there are many approaches in gravity that somehow they have to resort to emergent gravity ideas. There are ideas, like in Kassel said, where in a certain sense you definitely start with something which is not a gravitational degrees of freedom. But even in loop quantum gravity, at some point, you need to emerge space-time somehow. So even theories which apparently start quantizing gravitational degrees of freedom have to deal with the notion of emergence. So these are all interesting proposals, but they are very difficult. However, in recent time, we had developed a kind of interesting set of ideas and models, which are basically relying on condensed matter physics. And there are the so-called analog model of gravity for condensed matter physics. The basic analog model of gravity is to take just an hydrodynamic flow described by continuity in the Euler equation, consider sound waves on this flow, linearized perturbation of the density and the velocity potential, and you can show that this perturbation propagates like field in a curved space-time, which is the so-called acoustic metric. What you can do with this? You can do a lot of things. People, for example, is playing reproducing black hole in a lab with the hydrodynamic flow and try to measure the analog of Hawking radiation. Last year, we had the first measurement of the
analog of Hawking radiation in a surface wave analog gravity setting by the group of Bilurru in Vancouver. A very nifty experiment. If you haven't seen it, it's worth to give a look at the paper. And you can also study, for example, the analog cosmological expansion. You can reproduce in a system a metric which is analogous to the metric you expect to have during quasi the Sitter metric. Look at the expansion and look at the analog of cosmological particle creation. So you can do many things, but the things I want to do today is to look at a particular point, which is, can we use this model for doing something more than not just simulate a metric and the dynamics of fields on a metric, basically field theory in a curved space-time? Can we do something more than that? Can we really use them as a guideline or toy models for emergent gravity? So let's see how this is possible in a particular setting, the Bose-Einstein condensate. See, Bose-Einstein condensate are a very simple setting for doing analog gravity. The fact that there is analog gravity in a Bose-Einstein condensate should not surprise you. For people that know a little bit about Bose-Einstein condensate, you know that there is a superfluid phase. A superfluid is exactly the example you want to look for because it's something which is inviscid, no viscosity, and this is rotation. You can define the velocity potential. So you can basically recover a metric, an acoustic geometry on which perturbation will propagate. So let's start to see how it happens. Basically, the condensate is described by a nonlinear Schrödinger equation. You have this coupling constant which is related to the scattering length between the atoms. And this is true whenever you have a dilute gas of both particles, because otherwise you will have many body interaction with the complicate very much the things. The system is very difficult to solve, but generally people, what it does a mean field approximation, which is the natural things to do. You take the expectation value of the ground on the ground state, this is the so-called wave function of the condensate, plus excitation. The square of this wave function is exactly the density of particles, the number density in the condensate. And this is the part due to the excitation about the condensate. Note that the vacuum for the atoms is not the same as the vacuum for the excitation. Okay? The ground state is a vacuum for the excitation of the condensate, what they normally called in some approximation phonons, but it's not a vacuum for the atoms. This is going to be important. What you do is that you insert in that nonlinear Schrödinger equation this expansion in the wave function of the condensate and the excitation, and at some point you see you have a set of equations, one that is basically the equation describing the evolution of the background and the one for the excitation. You have terms that are basically giving you the back reaction of the excitation on the background. Let me, for the moment, ignore these terms and see what happens when we look at the dynamics of the excitation on the background. What you do is that you can basically do a particular change representation for the excitation. It would be the generalization for the excitation of the so-called Madelung representation, which for the people that was yesterday at Lee's talk is exactly psi equals square root of rho e to the I theta. This is what you need to do when you are doing it directly on the excitation. And you get basically two equations. This is like a continuity equation, and this is basically the equivalent of the Euler equation. There is a term here that spoils the analogy with hydrodynamics, which is called the quantum potential. This term can be neglected because it's suppressed by h bar square. And if you neglect it, then you can put together these two equations to get a second order field equation for the perturbation here in the phase. And voilà, you get D'Alembertian on a curved background for this field. This D'Alembertian is determined by a metric, which is exactly the acoustic geometry. This is exactly what happens when you have a simple fluid. Simply, we are now in the regime where normally you treat the Bose-Einstein as a superfluid. So this is the result you should get. There is a theorem, basically, that every time you have a baryotropic and inviscid flow, which is irrotational, means that you can write the velocity as the gradient of some scalar and the velocity potential, then this is always the metric on which perturbation propagates. So what are the lessons here? You see, you can see here that the perturbation, even if the system initially is non-relativistic, propagates on a relativistic background in our Lorentzian geometry. There are no Einstein equations here. The background equation have nothing to do with the GR. The atomic physics enters, basically becomes hidden once you go to this regime. The atomic physics is all in that, for example, in the speed of sound, in the fundamental constants that depend on the microscopic parameter. And of course, this symmetry, the Lorentzian symmetry of this equation, is accidental, because if I don't neglect this term, you will have correction and departure from perfect Lorentzian value. In fact, this is exactly what is happening. When you don't neglect the quantum potential, you see that the dispersion relation for the quasi-particle, that before was purely phononic, omega squared equals c squared k squared, but here is the speed of sound, gets a correction of higher order, which is basically ultraviolet Lorentz violation, which is obvious because the system underlying is non-relativistic. You should have that the characteristic, if you go at a very high energy, becomes infinite, no? Good? So what you can do with this? Well, as I said, a lot of people have played with this system too. You can quantize, of course. This is a quantum system. The theta 1 field that satisfies canonical commutation relation, you can perfectly quantize it, and you can try to reproduce Hawking radiation in a lab. You take a flow, Bose-Einstein condensate, you have a flow that becomes supersonic at some point, and you can look for the analog of Hawking radiation. There is a well-established technology for doing this, and there is an important result. Hawking radiation is very robust with respect to this correction. So you may be worried that Lorentz violation in the ultraviolet makes trouble to Hawking radiation, but actually helps solving many problems with Hawking radiation, like the Trans-Planckian problem, and basically leave the Hawking radiation unaffected if the surface gravity of the black hole is very different from the Planck. From this, the scale, the analog of this Planck scale, or the scale of Lorentz wave. Okay. The other things that we can try to do now is to go beyond. So, is it possible to use this system as well to do some sort of analog gravity, of emergent gravity? So, let's go back to the equation and look at the equation for the background. The equation for the background, you see, is obviously not relativistic, so there seems to be, there is no hope that you recover Einstein equation. However, you may wonder, okay, it's not relativistic, can I get at least something like a Poisson equation? So in order to get a Poisson equation, however, you need that the matter that, or the particle that propagate on this background must be massive. And the phonons in a Bose-Einstein are massless. What you need to do, you need to introduce a term which is a soft U-unbreaking. You basically, in jargon, the phonon becomes from a Goldstone boson, a pseudo-Goldstone boson. But nonetheless, you add a term which, moreover, in can say experimentally could be generated in a weird way, but from the point of view of us, it's just an academic study. We don't want to make it in a lab. With this term, you can show that the phonons acquire a mass. This mass is a composition, basically, of this lambda with the mass of the atom, and can be much smaller than the mass of the atom. And you have also a correction to the speed of sound, okay? So this is just a modification of your system to get massive quasi-particles. Now, the trick, what it is that, in principle, we want to arrive to something like this. So I want to see if I take the density of quasi-particle propagating on the background, how do they back react on the underlying condensate, on the underlying condensate, which is the one that determines the geometry. So one thing that you have to do to understand is what is the analog of the gravitational potential. So you perturb the flat, you take the acoustic metric to be flat, you perturb it, and you can show that basically the gravitational potential is related to only to perturbation in the density and takes this form. Basically, by looking at the Hamiltonian for quasi-particles in the non-relativistic beam. So once you know what is the analog of the gravitational potential, you have to see if it fits in an equation like this. So what you do, you go back to the equation for the background and look For example, when you have a source term made by some localized quasi-particle, to what shape it takes. To make a long story short, the end point is that you get this. You get exactly what you were expecting, you get the most general Poisson equation you can get. So what you get? You get that this equation for the background we saw at the start take the form of a Poisson equation where the gravitational potential is ruled by the source by the density of quasi-particles on the Bose-Einstein condensate plus a constant term. So we have a kind of cosmological constant term. If you have ever seen the Newtonian limit of Einstein gravity with a cosmological constant, you will see that the cosmological constant appears in this way. And then you have this strange term that normally is a sign of short-range gravity. So, of course, this is not a complete analogy with the standard case, because in this simple model, what is happening is that somehow gravity is short-range and is ruled by the scale. This L is exactly related to the scale of Lorentz violation. However, there is an interesting development of this. A former student of mine, Lorenzo Sintoni, has shown that when you consider a multi-component BSE, a BSE which is made with different kind of atoms, you can always find combination by which at least some gravitational potential will be long-range. There will be short-range, some particle will have a short-range gravitational potential that basically doesn't tell propagate at all, and some other will have instead this term equal to zero. Yes?
About how could you analog this? Why is this analog gravity attractive?
What is analog gravity?
Well, you're just saying there's an analog Newtonian here. Is it attractive?
Yes.
Well, is there a.
Attractive the force, you mean?
Yeah.
Yes, it is, but the problem is that there is a degree of arbitrariness. It depends on how you tune the microscopic parameters. That
it you can make it attractive.
Yes.
And is it? Is there any universality?
That means that all the phonons will fill the potential. That is less clear, and I think you can make it again with a high degree of fine-tuning. So why? There isn't. No, but I agree with you. Because there isn't anything underlying that is, you need a mechanism not to somehow give a dynamics in the underlying system to see if you might have an attractor toward that set of parameters that they can give you the right fine tuning. But it was not, the model was not aiming to so much to be such a complete model. I mean, the other point I want to make is that if one defines the Planck scale to be the effective G Newton, see G Newton here becomes a weird combination of the microscopic parameter. It's an emergent quantity, it's nothing fundamental. It's not related directly to a fundamental number that is there in the microscopic system. And if you define the Planck scale related to directly via the square root inverse of this G Newton, then you find that the relation between the Lorentz violating scale and the Planck scale, scaling this way, this combination, rho 0 a cube, is exactly the dilution factor, which I told you has to be much more, things has to be much less than 1 in order to write from the start to the Lagrangian we started with. So in this model, the Lorentz violation scale can be much longer than the Planck scale, which is kind of interesting because here Maxim Postolov recently proposed a model to solve a naturalness problem with Lorentz violating theory, which I will tell, that is exactly relying on this kind of situation. Another interesting point is that there is no locality. Why there is no locality? Because now you live in a world where apparently your fundamental particles are phonons, but phonons are no local objects because they are related to the atoms via Bogoliubov transformation. So when you have an interaction of phonons, it can never be point-like. At the end, in order to do the calculation, somehow you have to translate when you go to sufficiently small scale that in the atoms interaction. So the physics of these phonons, if you will try to do 4 phonons vertex, they will show a degree of non-locality, which is seems to me quite general because it's related directly to the fact that these are collective excitations. Now, the cosmological constant is another point. You see, what is happening here, the cosmological constant, what is related to? These are the...
Well, instead of explaining what are these two specific objects, I tell you what physically is related to. It comes out that symbol just tells you that the cosmological constant is not due to something in the condensate. It's due to the back reaction of the atoms which are not in the condensate. You see, exactly because the vacuum of the phonons is not equivalent to the vacuum of the atoms, there is a well-known thing in condensed matter theory which is called the depletion factor. So you put the condensate in the ground state, no phonons, there are always some atoms which are excited and which are not in the condensate. These atoms back react on the condensate, and this back reaction appears here as a constant in this equation for the condensate. And in a certain sense, it's unavoidable exactly because of the inequivalence of the vacuum.
Excuse me, this is a linear level, or is this worked out at the linear level, or just.
At the linear level, yes.
If you go, yeah, you try to go beyond the linear level.
No, it depends what you mean by linear level. Yeah.
So in the perturbation of
in phi, in the excitation. Yeah. Yes. No, we haven't. But basically, the analogy will break beyond the linear level. Yeah. But that is already also true for the joint, of course. There is a comment. This is more general. It's general that in general, in emergent gravity system. And in this Dynamo system in particular, it is expected that the energy of the vacuum cannot be calculated this way. Because this calculation is incomplete. You cannot just cut off at the effective field theory scale and get the answer. Because there is a UV completion that you know now, and you can define the true, I don't know, the grand canonical Hamiltonian for BDC, and you can calculate it. And this is the answer. This is the contribution from just the background, and this from the excitation. Or you can calculate, I don't know, it's just the eigenvalue from the Hamiltonian. However, our calculation is telling you that this was already suggested, for example, by Grisha-Volovic. But this calculation, explicit calculation, tells you the story is even more complicated than that. Because you see, in these results, you always have the background contribution. While we have shown that this background contribution is not there, meaning you can rewrite the cosmological constant, and see that we find that it's just due basically to the excitation beyond the condensate. So what is the lesson? The lesson is that there is no way you're going to predict a cosmological constant without knowing how gravity emerged. Secondly, you can guess the scale of the cosmological constant with effective field theory argument, because again, in the cosmological constant we found there is the scale of the effective field theory, which is here the alien length. But you will never guess this coefficient. You see, this is E lambda with respect to E Planck, defined with the G Newton as defined before. But you see, this is telling you that is order of what you would consider the effective field theory scale. But then there is this tiny coefficient that you cannot predict just with effective field theory arguments. So first, what gravitates actually needs the derivation of the dynamical equation. Secondly, the scale of what gravitates actually even can be misleading with just effective field theory arguments.
So what is the physical interpretation of this coefficient rho not aq? You say it should be assumed.
It's exactly the it's what condensed matter people call the dilution factor. It's telling you that the aq is the scale of interaction between atoms. It's the scattering length, yeah. S-wave scattering. Rho zero is the density of atoms in the condensate. Uh-huh. It's telling you that basically there are very few atoms. It's very dilute. The system, where the scale, the volume that is relevant is the volume of interaction, not the volume of the condensate. Okay? And the whole theory is not reliable if this is not much less than one. You need to work it, otherwise you have many atoms interaction, while the initial Lagrangian approach was relying on the fact that you have only two atoms interaction.
So there are two different ways you can think about the cutoff. One is just the scale about which you cannot trust the theory anymore, and the other is just the scale of the cosmological constant. Is the Planck mass?
Yes. Okay. This G Newton, you remember, was related directly to was found in the previous slide. G Newton. G Newton is derived The Planck mass is derived through the coefficient that enters in front of G of the source.
But is that where perturbative gravity breaks down? Is that in this Planck scale, or does it break down before that?
Depends what you mean by breakdown. Let's say that purely from formally what we are saying is that you group all the stuff which is not the density of phonons, of real phonons on the condenser, which happen to be the source of your percentage. This coefficient is this, and you see it's a combination basically of microscopic quantities. This coefficient, you call it G Newton, then you can define what in your theories, if you are a phonon living with this system, would call the Planck scale. But I wouldn't say that this is the scale at which the theory breaks down. You see, the Planck scale is an effective scale again.
Yes.
Here, it's a composite scale. So there is rather this scale is more directly related. This is the Lorentz bracket scale.
But this is an infrared scale.
No, but it depends. It can be smaller. This scale, what you can see is that again the ratio between the two goes with the dilution factor. So the Lorentz violation scale can be lower, longer than the Planck scale.
Yeah, but I mean, so that would be an infrared cutoff to the theory of gravity because I mean it's just a mass for gravity, not a UV cutoff. So that would.
But I don't know why you call it cutoff. It would simply say you that you would start to see Lorentz violation before the Planck scale.
Well, that's what I mean. So the GR just breaks down, basically, below that.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it breaks down. It would become something like Einstein Eder, who knows.
So I don't think I missed it. You're not talking about the rest of the particles. You're not implying something about their UV coefficient when you calculate the cosmic. I mean, like, it's just a standard model of particles. Here, you're just doing gravity as a particle.
Yes, but what I'm saying is that here you have gravity, and you have the analog of the particle living on the background.
Particles are the same lattice, in some sense, of the particle as the gravity.
What did they say?
Is the particle living on the same lattice, the same cutoff?
Yes.
Okay. So it's doing the same UV completion for
yes.
The rest of it.
Yeah, but the problem is that when you address a question like what is the ground state energy, if you go and just take the phonons and sum up, our standard calculation from this point of view is totally meaningless because you cannot just sum up the energy of the phonon cut off by the effective interior scale. You have you know that there is stuff beyond that. There is a transition, and you have so you can define the energy of the system, the ground. And state energy of the system completely from the fundamental Hamiltonian. So that is the. But what it's telling you is that even this that was suggested is not giving you the right answer because not all of this gravitates. Only a part of this, which is the stuff of the atoms which are not in the condenser, which are outside of the condenser, the excitation above the condenser. Okay? So, and not only, but you see that automatically
the energy associated with this cosmological constant, if the condenser is dilute, as it should be, is much smaller than the natural Planck scale. So the naturalness problem of the cosmological constant is natural here.
Like what? There are no electrons in the Bose-Einstein condensate, no? What
right, so, but we do, I mean, the standard model also would...
Right, but then if you want to do something like a standard model, you need to develop an analog model of gravity, which has much more complication than this. See, I'm not telling you that this is a model of reality. I'm telling you that, nonetheless, it's teaching you some interesting lessons about how, for example, the cosmological constant problem has to be interpreted in an emerging gravity framework. So it's exactly because it's a simple solvable model that it helps you understand something. So now the second part of the final part of the talk
will be exactly regarding another issue that we touched, which is the issue of Lorentz violation. You see, in all these analog gravity models, the Lorentz violation is crucial. Because somehow, if the space-time is emerged, at some point the symmetry of space-time is going to be emerged. And boost invariance, in particular in these models which have a natural granulosity, because underlying the fluid there is a set of atoms, a Lorentz violation is unavoidable. Now, Lorentz violation is not just academic, because we can put constraints, for example, on the kind of dispersion relation I discussed so far. So the interesting point is that they not only inspire, but they also give you another example with respect to some quantum gravity models. There were preliminary calculations in loop quantum gravity, which is not a prediction of loop quantum gravity, but some mind-waving calculation were leading to expectations. Right. But anyway, there are also other models in brain cosmology and so on that were suggesting that the Lorentz violation could be something that you could expect, to not talk about the recent development with the Orava gravity and so on. So let's see what is happening once we have the sort of modified dispersion relation that you have. So what I'm now discussing is, can we do something more than just contemplate that this is a possibility? Can we cast constraint on this? Now, the answer is yes, and we can cast constraint on using many observations, which are the so-called windows on quantum gravity. The basic idea is the following, that, of course, Planck suppressed Lorentz violation is a tiny violation. However, if you have a cumulative effect, for example, on cosmological scales, or if you have effects which are really very sensitive to, for example, even tiny modification of the dispersion relation, like threshold effect, then you can see the effect of this tiny violation, and you can cast constraint. So let me review, for example, where we stand there. Of course, before to cast constraint, I just want to spend one moment on the fact that there are very many frameworks in which you can try to cast constraint. And not all these frameworks are constrained so far. I will talk now of a particular route which was the first that people follow, which is the most obvious. Well, you want to introduce Lorentz violation, I take QED, and I start adding order by order Lorentz violating operators, which are more and more suppressed in some Lorentz violating scale that generally is associated to be the Planck scale. This, for example, this result was done exactly by Myers and Pospel over here in 2003, where they worked out how QED is modified when you have Lorentz violation with dimension 5, mass dimension 5 of those. So what you can do here, I just want to give you a flavor how you can cast constraint in this case. For example, take the Grab Nebula. The Grab Nebula is about 2 kiloparsec away. It's a very interesting object. And what you can do with a Crab Nebula, you know that has a two-arm spectrum, a synchrotron spectrum and inverse quantum spectrum. And basically, with a Crab Nebula, we can do basically everything to constrain the theory that was given us by Myers and Pospel. The first things you can do, for example, is that you can recalculate the synchrotron spectrum in the presence of that modification of QED. And it's obvious that the synchrotron spectrum is going to be changed, because this is the formula for the emission of photons by the synchrotron radiation. And you see it depends on the gamma factor to the Coupe power. But the gamma factor, if you have a Lorentz violation at order E cube over M, automatically will get this correction. And this correction can play in two ways. Or it can tell you that whatever is the energy of the electron, you cannot create a synchrotron photon higher than a given frequency, or it can completely blow up the synchrotron spectrum and make the electron radiate almost immediately all its energy. So it will modify the synchrotron spectrum, and using standard astrophysics technique, you can recompute it and cast constraint. And another things that it does, the theory that Myers and Pospel consider, had another simple feature that was that the two polarization of the photon travel at different speeds. So what is happening is that if you start with linear polarization and you have two photons of different energy, they rotate, and like a Faraday rotation, but they rotate at different speeds. If after a while they come perpendicular, for example, you have lost most of your polarization. So if I detect the polarized light from the Crab Nebula, I know that this Lorentz violation cannot be too large. This is how the polarization decreases. And in this way, you can cast a very strong constraint. Basically, here is the coefficient for the photon. This is the one for the electron. For the photon, we are between 10 to the minus 10, 10 to the minus 12. And here is between 10 to the minus 6 and 10 to the plus and minus 10 to the minus 6. So what is telling you? It's telling you that we can effectively do immediately phenomenology of quantum gravity idea, like possibility of Lorentz violation at the Planck scale. The coefficient there are naturally of order one. So if you find something of order like this, you know that basically the theory is over constrained.
Less, I have much less energy than Planck scale, but somehow your synchrotron radiation is affected a lot, so I
can have yeah, go. Exactly for this reason. Calculate the gamma factor. The critical frequency, most of the synchrotron radiation is emitted at this frequency. Depends on gamma 2.
Yeah.
Compute the gamma with the modified dispersion relation. So the group velocity is now modified, no? So you have this term. The plus or minus depends if the dispersion relation is becoming superluminal or subluminal in general. You see, for example, if there is a minus here, whatever is the energy of the electron, at some point you reach zero here. Okay? So in one case you superradiate, in the other case basically whatever you put is the energy you give the electron, you cannot radiate more than that. And this modifies the spectrum of the synchrotron in a very sensible way. And another way to cast constraint, you can go even beyond. What if we k to the 4p to the 4, the next order? The way here we cast the constraint is the following. We know that in cosmic ray physics, there is the so-called GZK reaction, where a proton meets a photon, create pions. These pions produce spontaneously decay and create photons. You can check that Lorentz violation does not affect that part of the story too much. Now, these photons are very energetic, around 10 to the 20 electron volt. Remember, the Planck scale is 10 to the 28 electron volt. Now, normally we don't see them because they are absorbed by basically the cosmic microwave background, creating a particle pair of electron positive. This is a well-known effect, and this is why the universe is opaque to this high energy photon. Let's go. Because otherwise. But we know that these photons are, and indeed we know that this is happening because we don't see this huge amount of high energy photons. Okay? Now, what you can do is the following. You see, when you have Lorentz violation like this, you can show that this reaction, which normally has, of course, a threshold in order to happen. You needed to have this gamma. This is the target gamma, it's a fixed energy. This mass must have enough energy to give the mass to the electrons, right? But you can show that there is also an upper threshold. Basically, what happens is that given the initial energy and the range of energy of the final product, so there is an initial moment in which the reaction starts and a moment in which it ends. If you are above that moment, above the upper threshold, all these photons see the universe as transparent and they arrive to us. But we know that they don't. So we know that the energy at which they live should be below the upper threshold. And this gives you a very strong constraint because cuts away a whole part of the phase space, the parameter space. If in addition to this, we know that with this dispersion relation, a photon, the basic diagram of QED, photon in electron positron, which normally is forbidden by energy momentum conservation, can be allowed. Then you also see that if we will ever see one of these high energy photons, it will be below the threshold for doing a spontaneous decay in an electron positron pair. So once we will see this photon, which is expected soon with Auger, because they should detect a part of the spectrum. You'd expect it to be 1% of the cosmic ray spectrum. Then you will cap the space again. So you will get 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 8. And you can constrain very rapidly also that part of the Lorentz violation. So now I'm finishing time. So there is a caveat with all this investigation about Lorentz violation, which is related to the fact that there are radiative corrections, so even if you start with a k to the fourth of Lorentz violation, it will percolate down to k squared Lorentz violation, which are very constrained. The constraint on possibility of different speed of light or different particles are very good. And this naturalness problem is a problem that may be solved if you have a custodial symmetry somehow protecting forbidding the lowest order operators to be switched on. Like supersymmetry may do that thing. So there is people here that has worked a lot in this field. And I just want to say that also condensed matter, basically that you can study system with two BC components and see that some mechanism that could protect as well. As well, recently there is the idea that maybe one way out is to put the Lorentz violation only in the gravity sector, like in orava gravity, but not in the matter. And then basically the matter will acquire Lorentz violation by radiative correction, but it will be suppressed basically by G Newton, which is very small. So you will have that if the Lorentz breaking gravity is much longer than the Planck scale, you will be safe. Which is, by the way, the kind of situation we found in our BC model. So, it's the end of the story. So if it is, but these are the numbers, basically, the most updated numbers on the constraint in the different sector. So I would say that it's definitely appearing that if there is an effective field theory with Lorentz violation, if your theory predicted, you are in trouble, because the constraints by now are starting to be convincingly and consistently very good. However, can we say that the mission is accomplished and we shouldn't worry anymore about special relativity with respect? Well, like in this case, maybe that this is not the case. Do I have a few extra minutes? Okay, so, and let me try to explain you why I don't say that the mission is accomplished. Because, okay, we have tested the most simple form of Lorentz violation that you can imagine, an effective field theory where you add order by order these Lorentz violating operators. But is it really the only things we can consider? Let's go back to the fundamentals about special relativity. You know that special relativity can be derived in an axiomatic way. The so-called Bonin-Yatovsky theorem by 1911 is basically telling you that you need to assume a few axioms, which are the following. Homogeneity and isotropy of space-time. The principle of relativity, of course. And you need to assume what is called precausality. You need to say that if two events have some time ordering, two colocal events have some time ordering in a given point of space-time, the time ordering is preserved by going to another system of reference. Okay? So it's less than causality, it's called precausality in this sense. Once you have this ingredient, you can derive the Lorentz transformation with the speed, an invariant speed, which can be infinite, and then you recover Galileo, or it can be fixed by experiment to be equal to the speed of light. Only experiment is going to tell you that. Hmm? Moreover, if you would be in an analog gravity and do your experiment with phonons, you will be misled. And you will think that this is the speed of sound. There is an interesting paper by Barcelo and G. Jens on this, which is another interesting, because there the Lorentz-Bruggera contraction is really a Lorentz-Bruggera contraction in analog gravity.
It's really a what? I'm sorry?
A Lorentz-Bruggera contraction. Mean that
you remember the original idea, the Lorentz-Bruggera idea, about the fact that really there was a contraction of the arms of the interferometer, mm-hmm. depending on how they were moving with respect to the other.
So, for example, you can play games. Can we preserve the relativity principle but give up isotropy? If you give up isotropy, yes, you can do that. And you have, in two dimensions, for example, you can find a relativity group which has the same number of generators, and the invariant line element is a Finsler geometry. But if you try to do it in 3 plus 1 dimension, there is a problem because there are other rotations. You can break the rotation. You can give an isotropy in one direction, so you will break basically the rotation group. And you will have a group which has less number of generators. And this is what is called very special relativity, which again has an invariant element, which is a Finsler geometry. For those of you that do not know what is a Finsler geometry, I don't have to explain. But it's basically a generalization of Riemann geometry where the geometry depends on the point and the tangent vector at the point. Okay. So I'm trying to wrap up because evidently the things are... so you can all... By precausality, I don't want to even think about it, but homogeneity, for example, is related to differentiability, and it probably is the most interesting thing to give up. And what is happening when you give up the homogeneity is unclear, but it may be related substantially to change the
fine structure of the space on which you live. And that is another thing that is worth exploring. And then there are, I would say that from this set of ideas, you really naturally go toward the idea like double special relativity, try to build a relativity group which has the same number of generators of special relativity, but includes the Planck scale as an invariant scale, or to more recent idea like local relativity as produced by Lee, Norant, Giovanni Melino Camelia, and Kowalski. So I think that here I will skip the final part of my talk. Let me just make the final comment, which was regarding, so back to the desk. So why you're insisting, you can tell me why you're insisting looking at Lorentz violation. And my gut feeling is that if you want to have emergence of space-time, and you want to have Lorentz invariants at all scale, you complicate, it's conceptually possible, but it may be not the best rule. I mean, these kind of analogies are telling you that in a certain sense, Lorentz violation can be beneficial, and it's just a matter of how to treat it. If you have a custodial symmetry, or if you can relegate, for example, to a lower number of dimension, and then construct the space-time by putting together elements which are endowed with non-relativistic physics. I know that now the time is short, so I don't have the time to elaborate this point. But I just want to finish on the fact that another point that is not very much discussed, but I think is interesting, is the fact of the role of diffeomorphism invariants. Well, and the only things I want to say is that there is another important point here. Diffeomorphism invariants, for those of you which are familiar with black hole physics, is related to the Noether charge. It provides you with a Noether charge which wants to have a space-time with a bifurcated Killing horizon, is identified with the entropy of that horizon. Basically, you can identify it with the Vegas canonical entropy, right? So it seems that the diffeomorphism invariant is as well a very important ingredient that enters in the thermodynamic aspects of gravity. If the fact that this is a thermodynamical aspect, you take it as a face value, as the fact that it should be emergent because it is part of the thermodynamics. Could we take in the future that the diffeomorphism invariant is a fundamental feature, also the fundamental theory? So the point is, could we consider also a phenomenology of departure from the diffeomorphism invariant as well, as another possibility to do quantum gravity phenomenology? So at this point, I think I can close skipping the last part, which in many ways was a toy model, try to derive something that was approximately different value from something that wasn't a different value. And I will go to the conclusion. So the conclusion is basically, this is a summary of what I say. And the point I want to make in the conclusion of this, let's go back for a final comment to the start, to the thermodynamics approach of algebras. It seems to be a very strong hint for emergent gravity. It seems very difficult to emerge gravity without having emergent symmetries of gravity, in particular local Lorentz invariant. However, local Lorentz invariant seems to be incompatible with Jacobson approach. This is the last comment. This is, I think, is another very important problem we need to understand. If I try to introduce Lorentz breaking in black hole thermodynamics, I immediately violate the generalized second law. I can build a perpetuum mobile, basically, exchanging heat between two shells because the horizon is no more unique for all the fields. Okay. However, and the Urbo radiation is killed, apparently, by the presence of Lorentz radiation because it's not robust as the Hawking radiation. So here is, if you really want to emerge in gravity, here is for you a problem, which is how the thermodynamical aspect of gravity can be made compatible with theory, for example, like Orello gravity or Estenella gravity. Because I think that that would tell you if you can afford that, a form of departure from special relativity, not necessarily the Lorentz violation in effective theory show, but any departure. And if this departure is still compatible with thermodynamical aspect of gravity. Thank you.